Chapter 1980. Busted. Sitting out in the cold. The game. Baltimore Orioles 5, Chicago White Sox 3. Comiskey Park, Chicago, Illinois. Attendance 35,539. Thursday, April 10th, 1980. The weather was cold. Really cold. 40s and windy. Hall of Famers, Orioles manager Earl Weaver, pitcher Jim Palmer, first baseman Eddie Murray, White Sox manager Tony La Russa, and outfielder Harold Baines. Game highlights. This would be 34-year-old Tony La Russa's first full season managing the White Sox. The youngest skipper in baseball at the time was called up from Chicago's top minor league club in August 1979 in hopes of turning the team around. While La Russa's Hall of Fame managerial career would eventually blossom in Chicago, and Oakland, and St. Louis, his team's performance today would not contribute to that legacy. Fans' first impression of the 1980 White Sox was as bad as it had been a year earlier, as the first four Orioles batters reached base and came around to score, thanks, in part, to a hit batter, a balk, a fielding error. Harry Carey and organist Nancy Faust's seventh-inning stretch must have been especially inspiring, as the Sox would rally for three runs in the seventh and eighth, but not enough to overcome the game-opening debacle. The story. On the morning after this opening day, a photo on the front page of the Chicago Tribune sports section said a lot. It was of a mom holding her son, waving a pair of American flags, wrapped in a heavy blanket, and dressed as if they were at a football playoff game in January. Not what was supposed to be a rite of spring? The flags might have been motivated by the lingering infusion of nationalistic pride sparked by the United States' stunning hockey victory over the heavily favored Soviet Union at the Winter Olympic Games just a few weeks earlier. Regardless of their patriotic motives, the wardrobe had become something of an opening day necessity in Chicago. In the decades that followed, baseball's weather-resistant options for season openers became more numerous. Expansion had recently brought domed stadiums into the American League in Seattle and Toronto. Future expansion would welcome three new teams in states better known for spring training than the regular season, Florida and Arizona. They had just broken ground for a new domed stadium in Minneapolis for the Minnesota Twins, and another retractable dome would be coming to Milwaukee. But in April 1980, teams in places like Boston, New York, Detroit, Cleveland, and Chicago had to live with the harsh whims of nature. While we endured some pretty miserable weather on opening days over 50 years, including this one in 1980, no experience was more memorable than a modified opening day 2 years later when two college kids learned an unexpected lesson about the power of television, both of whom would eventually earn their living in the television industry. From that Notre Dame crew of sports media friends came Skip Disjardin. We worked together at The Observer and WSND, and after college, we enjoyed a couple of coincidental, concurrent professional experiences in TV production and distribution in the 1980s and 90s. Born and bred in New England, Skip was determined to see his Boston Red Sox play whenever he could, even while in college. In 1982, the Red Sox were to have opened the season against the White Sox, but Mother Nature had a different plan. A spring snowstorm rocked everything from Chicago to Boston, forcing the season's first two games at Comiskey to be rescheduled as a twi-night doubleheader on an open date for both Sox schedules just 3 weeks later. By April 26, each team had managed to play more than a dozen games, but to Skip, this was opening day. The atmosphere at Comiskey suggested otherwise. The snow might have melted, but the game-time temperature was near freezing, and the wind was blowing, of course. These were the days before the so-called day-night doubleheader, so instead of playing one game in the afternoon, clearing the ballpark, then reloading for the nightcap, the teams would play two games, back-to-back, starting at 5 p.m. Tickets were readily available. Box seats for $7, general admission tickets for $3. On a college budget, we opted for the latter. Two games for $3. Couldn't beat it. Comiskey was so empty and quiet, you could practically hear Joe McConnell's play-by-play from the press box without a radio. Announced attendance was 5,798. In those days, teams announced tickets used, not tickets sold. The evolution of revenue sharing among the teams sparked a policy change in the 1990s. As the wind continued to whip through the ballpark and the temperature dropped, so did the number of fans in attendance. After Chicago lost Game 1, there seemed to be only a few hundred spectators left to experience Game 2. Skip and I decided to attempt an upgrade. We had no trouble moving to the type of seats Bob Uecker once tried to claim, except in our case, the ushers had fled the freezing cold. No one checked our tickets. There we were in the front row, right next to the on-deck circle, and no one except the umpire and a few players within 100 feet of us. We stayed until Skip's Red Sox completed the sweep just after 10:30 p.m. A couple of days later, Skip was having the weekly phone call with his parents back home in Auburn, Maine. After the routine exchange of pleasantries, the conversation turned toward academics and preparation for impending final exams. "These are going to be really tough," Skip told his father. "I'm putting in a lot of hours studying a lot." "Now that you're a senior, tougher than before?" "Absolutely, Dad," Skip responded. "Surprisingly tough." "Glad to know you're working hard, son." "Really am, Dad." "All the time?" his father asked intently. Skip started to squirm. Just about, he responded honestly. I need to break to eat and sleep, but yeah, pretty much all the time." "Even Monday night?" Deep breath. Skip knew a lot was riding on the integrity of his next answer as he pondered how much his dad knew and how he knew it. "Now that you mention it, Dad, I did take a break Monday to see the Sox." "Was that Ortman with you?" Sure was," Skip replied, now realizing that thanks to our ill-advised seat upgrade, we'd been caught on camera more than once in the game telecast back home on Channel 38 WSBK TV. We'd always heard parents had eyes in the back of their heads. This time, we made it way too easy for them. For the box scores, play-by-play, and more, visit openingday5050.com.